Say enough, he practice fi eat parrot fish, cause of them clean the coral reef there. Jamaica little the safety parrot fish, cause of them bring the sand from we beach them. Yeah. Whether you are the buyer, seller or the fisherman, say you can help save our island. Do not bring no parrot fish, come as dry land. Fisherman, put away your hook and your nylon. Make we stop try erode the soil of safety parrot fish.
Brought to you by Sandals Resorts, the Jamaica Observer, and Rainforest Seafoods.
Welcome back to Talk Jamaica here on One Radio via oneradio.link and also via our One Radio mobile app. We now take you inside In Perspective.
It's now time for In Perspective.
Good afternoon, listeners, and thank you for staying with us for another segment of In Perspective. I trust you had a great week. Looking forward to a productive week. This afternoon, listeners, I want to put to you, as I usually do, questions, and you can sift through the rumbles and you can sift through the anecdotes and see whether or not you can come to your very own conclusion. And the question I'm asking you this afternoon, listeners, is whether or not, when you look around and you weigh things, if democracy in Jamaica is a threat, whether or not there's a threat to democracy in Jamaica. And last week, my co-host brilliantly spoke about the whole idea of the seemingly cancellation of the regular press briefings. Something that the Press Association of Jamaica has spoken about. And we have heard that those meetings, those press briefings would have resumed. And we're looking forward to them. But the question is whether or not democracy is under threat in Jamaica. Because what could have prompted this administration to have cancelled those press briefings and have not had one since November? What is it that this administration doesn't want to face up to? Now, listeners, I have had the luxury of watching the live stream of the Parliament, usually on a Tuesday. I rarely get to watch the Senate on a Friday. And so, I have seen over and over again, listeners, where this present administration have used their majority to stifle or attempt to stifle the voice of the opposition. And so the question is democracy a threat in Jamaica? A point in question, the whole issue of the National Identification System, the NIDS program, when that bill was being debated in the Parliament, this administration attempted at every time to stifle suggestions, use their majority to overrule suggestions made by the opposition. And here we are today, where the opposition has decided on behalf of the people to take certain aspects of that bill law to the court for the court to make a ruling on it. So we have to ask ourselves again, is democracy at threat in Jamaica? The other issue, listeners, that has surfaced this week is that the former director of the Electoral Office of Jamaica, Orit Fisher, has made some damning accusation against one particular member of the commission who he felt had inserted political interference into our electoral system. Yes? Damning accusation. Intimidation and threat, one can deduce from the letter that was read into the public domain. So we must ask ourselves the question, is democracy a threat in Jamaica? Listeners, again, ask yourself, when you hear the crass and vulgar Everall Warmington, who is a minister out of the office of the prime minister, attacking the freedom of the press, making scathing remarks as to the media is out to bring some kind of conspiracy theory. Yes, some kind of conspiracy theory he has thought about in his warped thinking. Yes, that the media is out to bring down this Andrew Holness administration. Where did Mr. Holness get his, Mr. Warmington get his information from? Yes? And he went on to call persons in the media that they're engaging in gutter. And nobody engages in gutter more than Mr. Warmington. So are we to understand, listeners, that the press must not report on issues in the government? Mr. Warmington can have an argument if there is erroneous information put out in the press and they have asked for it to be retracted and it has not been retracted properly. Then he could have an argument. But I don't know where he got his conspiracy theory from. Right? So we must ask ourselves the question whether or not democracy is really a threat in Jamaica and whether or not this administration is towing the line on freedom of speech. And that, listeners, is In Perspective.
That was In Perspective.
All right, listeners, welcome back to Talk Jamaica here on One Radio. We are streaming live via oneradio.link and you can listen to us via the One Radio mobile app. My name is Ralston Chamberlain. My co-host this afternoon is Sanjay Lewis. Listeners, we now present a review of some of the top stories from the week. That was the first story this afternoon. Teachers and government agreed to a 16% deal. So on Wednesday of this week, the Minister of Finance and the Public Services, Dr. Nigel Clark, and Mrs. Georgia War-Richards, who is the President of Jamaica Teachers Association, signed a new four-year wage deal for the period 2017-2021. This is after months of back and forth between the two bodies. The teachers have accepted a wage deal from the government. The government had initially said it can't afford to give more than 6% increase for the period, but the final agreement, yes, 16% increase agreed on. This is welcoming news, I think, given that there was a stalemate between the teachers and the government in this regard. But this, I welcome this and hope that if there others who haven't come on, but the government has said that they cannot afford more than 16%. And my understanding is that the discussion is that they have gotten more in terms of the fringe benefits that they were asking for. So this is welcoming news for both the teachers and the government.
It would be interesting to hear the specifics of the deal that was brokered, because as you mentioned, the fringe benefits part of it is what I'm particularly interested in, to see what the government promised to the teachers, why this agreement or how this agreement came to a final signing. So it'd be interesting to hear, because I don't know if you have seen it anywhere else, then, but I haven't certainly seen it anywhere where we have gotten the specifics of the deal. And I know there was this story floating around about teachers being paid to mark SBAs. And I know that there was some story that there's a possibility that parents may have been charged for that. But I don't know if there is any part of this deal where there is any comment or any suggestion about SBAs being, teachers being paid to mark SBA. So it'd be interesting to see the specifics of the deal.
Absolutely. I saw where the president of the JTA, when questioned as to what really had changed in response to a question from the media, what really had changed in terms of the deal, she was quite hesitant. Yes. In explaining, right? So I absolutely agree with you that we ought to know what is it that we as taxpayers are being asked to fund.
She's what very tight-lipped on it, as a matter of fact.
What changes really had taken place from then until now?
She's very tight-lipped as it relates to it. And my understanding is that when she was quizzed on it, she mentioned that she, and rightly so, have to speak to her membership to inform them of the deal before she provides any information to the media. Now, my understanding is that she spoke to her membership, or should have spoken to the membership, on Friday. So it would be interesting now to see and to see if she's going to disclose the particulars of the deal, because I think it's imperative that as taxpayers we know what the government and the teachers have signed off to, because it's not the government's money, it's taxpayers' dollars. So we need to know what was the final agreement. And it would have been good if, and I understand that the membership must be notified first, but I find it particularly interesting also because when she was quizzed, she said she would have to inform her membership of the deal. So wouldn't it be a case that the membership would have voted and agree on a specific amount and then they sign?
Not necessarily. So from my understanding from it is that they get the negotiating team from the JTA gets an offer. They agree on an offer with the government. Then they go back and discuss it at what would call an executive level. Yes? So and then from that executive, so they agree in the executive body, okay, we will take this. So so that body is kind of a group of members that would say, all right, we agree. So basically, it's kind of would be a feedback from members that they would have agreed in that smaller body. Mm-hmm. And then they agree on that, they sign off on that, and then I believe they take it to the members and say, this is what we have agreed and signed off on. That's my understanding of how the process works.
Interesting.
So it could be that the smaller body agreed on it, mm-hmm. but they have not really put it out to the bigger group of teachers, say the island-wide teachers, to say, okay, this is what we have agreed on.
I see the nurses still haven't agreed on a deal. My understanding is that they're still not in agreement to the proposal made by the government. Another thing, though, that I listened to the Police Federation, the outgoing head, McCullough, Sergeant McCullough, last week. I don't know if you happened to hear the excerpts from his presentation at the conference that was held last week. But he made some statements that to me was troubling. Troubling because he painted a picture, and I understand that he was speaking to his constituents. So therefore, it is necessary that he rile up the crowd. And one of the things that he said was that Indicom, as you know, is taking the matter of the powers of arrest to the Privy Council. And the Police Federation is putting the government on warning that the government, by extension again, taxpayers, are going to be the ones. He didn't ask, you know, he said that the government will foot the bill for the Police Federation to challenge Indicom at the Privy Council level. And I found that very strange to me that the Police Federation is calling on the taxpayers to challenge Indicom at the Privy Council. If they have an issue with Indicom having a problem with a ruling that was placed in the court, I would think that it's for the Police Federation to foot that bill and not the taxpayers of this country. The other thing that he said was that he spoke about the overtime for police officers and police officers not receiving overtime. And he also spoke about the working condition of the police officers. And I have no issue with that. What I didn't hear coming out of that speech is the flip side of some of these police officers that we have in the force who are rogue police officers and charging his membership to ensure that they follow the rule of law. Because let's not hide and pretend as if we don't have rogue cops in the force. And he gave the impression that the police force is this rosy organization that is not in need of any repair. And when I listened to him, I stopped and I wondered, if I wasn't somebody who read and know what's happening, I would think that this is a rosy police force with no issues.
I didn't hear the speech given by the gentleman. However, I'll agree with you on the broader context of the issues that you have pointed out, because this is something that we have spoken about on this program over time and time again. How it is that we have these rogue cops who we seem to not be able to flush them out of the Jamaica Constabulary Force. I recall that the former Minister of National Security indicated that they have information about these rogue cops and they are going to retire them in the public's interest. We have not seen any move on that. And so the question I asked then, which I'm going to ask now, is if it is that we have information about these rogue cops that we know are painting a bad light on the Jamaica Constabulary Force, how is it that we are not able to get them out of the force? That's the big question. How is it that we're not able to get them out of the force? And therefore, I mean, the head of the our former head of the Police Federation, that's his position, that's his job. He is doing he is supposed to do in regards to his members. But now that we have seen where a female has been named to that post, let us hope, yes, that she will work in tandem with the police commissioner and with the Minister of National Security to ensure to ensure that we rid the force of these rogue cops, because it makes absolutely no sense that we attempt to solve crime when we have these rogue cops within the force.
And you know, which carries me to the story that we have, and I was going to jump a little bit, Rawson, since we're on the topic. It brings me to the story about the cops planting guns, the report of Indicom, because Indicom is reporting that police officers, it is alleged that police officers are planting firearms on victims who they have killed. And that to me is troubling, because it says to me that the persons who are supposed to uphold the law while serving and protecting us as a people, as people, as law-abiding citizens in this country, we can't trust them. Because if you are going to go and kill someone and then plant a gun, yes, it means that something is seriously wrong within the police force. And who are these people that we have who are supposed to uphold the law and who are supposed to be fair in carrying out their responsibility as decent law-abiding citizens who have a responsibility, right, to serve and protect the people of this country? How is it that we have cops planting guns? And I know that people are saying it's nothing new. Yes, it's nothing new. Well, we have heard it before. But again, it goes back to the root problem that, and the initial statement that you have made, Ralston, is what is it that, you know, have been done to get rid of these rogue cops that are in the force?
You know, this whole issue of police cops planting gun, it's not a new issue. This is something that has been happening from ever since. And it was with this in mind as well, and other issues why Bruce Golden came up with the whole Indicom, Independent Commission of Investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was after hearing these several cries all the time by members of the public that police were planting guns and police were doing this and police were doing that at crime scene. That's why Bruce Golden came up with Indicom, so we could have an independent body to investigate these issues and claims, right? But we have seen, and sadly we have, sadly we have seen where Indicom seem to be now be coming under threat. And here's why I say this. I hear the leader of the opposition made accusation in the parliament about the work that Indicom is doing. I hear the prime minister lambasting Indicom as well. If our elected leaders are going to attack the very body that is supposed to prevent or seek to prevent these kind of issues where cops are planting guns, where are we to go from here? So instead of strengthening Indicom, I see where Indicom is being weakened, right? Are we going to move away from this? But not only coupled with that, I hear where Hamish Campbell was saying that it's... So the corruption as well stems within the Bureau of Special Investigation, because it's there. It is in that organized, that body, which is within the JCF still, that these guns, when found, that's where they go to be tested, to do the ballistic testing. So the guns go there, and then you see the very same gun that go there at one incident is now turning up at another incident. So is it now that we need to look at whether or not we should move the Bureau of Special Investigation from out of the JCF and put it within Indicom, so that they can so that we can have this clear route where investigations are done and are done without the corruption that exists within the Jamaica Constabulary Force. It is absolutely sad. And we hear poor people complaining about this all the time, where a young man is gunned down and you hear that he opened fire at police. He opened fire and you see this high-powered weapon is found, yet still none of the policemen ever get armed. So this it leaves a lot of question in well-thinking Jamaicans' mind. What is really going on in terms of how policemen do policing? And this is the corruption that we're talking about.
But you see, another story is out. I'm seeing a story published today by Loop, where it says that the Westmoreland police have taken into custody a man after they have found military fatigue in the parish on this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question that I have to ask is, how is it that this individual could have gotten hold on military
fatigue
and police fatigue? How? Something is wrong. Because if the process of getting the military and police fatigue is so stringent, and I use stringent very loosely, yes? It simply means that someone on the inside would have been able to give this individual access to it, because it's not like you can just go on the street and make the insignia of the police force. And my understanding is that the insignia match that of the police. So it's not even like somebody make something that, you know, probably look as close as what the police would wear. So it seems to me that it's an inside job. And if it is an inside job, it means that someone within the police force, someone in the military, is leaking or giving these stuff to the criminals. And if we have these people who are supposed to serve and protect us helping the criminals, then we're in a serious problem in this country.
But, you know, it comes back to one of the things, and it's one of the things that many are saying, that is because in order for I'm putting it this way, that when a policeman decides to engage in criminality, it simply means that at some point he or she is benefiting,
of course,
from this criminality. So then the argument then can be made that, oh, we don't pay our police enough, and so if we don't pay them enough, then they have to now engage in these criminal activities, which will earn them additional money.
And I don't buy that story. Because we can list several other persons in several other professions that don't earn, and they're not resorting to criminality.
No, but you see, the if we look at other professions, there is not this propensity where the criminality exists. So within the police force, there is that propensity where the criminality exists. They are out there, and they can take bribe. They can engage in with dons who extort to be a part of it. For instance, in the teaching profession, where they are not paid enough. If we were to juxtapose it with that, where within the broader scope of teaching does that kind of opportunity exist for criminality to take place? So if you understand what I'm saying, is that within the force, there exists... It's easier then for them to partake in that kind of criminality that exists, yes? And so they can say, oh, we don't get enough, so they don't pay us enough. So let's just be a part of where we can earn more. You know, but you know, but the more serious issue, I think, and it is something that we have agreed on, is how is it that we are going to root out from within the force these criminal elements? I've said it before that there are men and women in the police force who are just there to eat a food. It's just that eat a food mentality that they have used to get in. Yes, because it is an easy way to get in. And so once I get in, then I'll see how I can enrich myself, whether it's legally or illegally.
You know, there's a long-standing conversation about overhauling the police force. And I remember when Peter Bunting was Minister of National Security, he spoke to it. And there was a question about scrapping the police force and starting back from scratch. And renaming it Jamaica Police Service instead of Jamaica Constabulary Force. And a lot of things were, you know, touted about. But whatever the case is, we have a serious problem. And this is a problem that didn't start overnight. Yes? And I agree with you that we can't turn a blind eye to the salary that these police officers are earning. Because you can't expect to get qualified individuals to join the force, one, if you're not paying them the money that they need. Yes, that's one. And the other thing too that I question is the qualification of these individuals that we take to become police officers, because some of these very persons that we take to become police officers move up in the system and eventually become investigators. Now we hear the story from the DPP. We hear the story in the court where cases many times are thrown out because the investigation is not done properly, or files are incomplete, files are missing. Yes? What does that say about the quality of persons that we have as police officers, that we have as investigators? How is it that the training of these persons are done? That's another question that we have to ask, separate and apart from the conversation about salary, because salary is very much important, because we can't expect to be paying these individuals chicken feed money and then expect A-class quality service. We pay for what we get in. Mm-hmm. And it's a serious conversation.
But I don't think I want to agree to question how is it that the training is done, because it cannot be. We cannot then say, oh, they're not getting adequate training, so that the whole idea of them becoming rogue cop is not of not becoming a rogue cop is not instilled in the training, because I'm almost sure that they get the whole issue of how the profession is to operate must be taken into consideration when they're doing the training. So it's a very, very very, very hard thing to understand. There is so much about it that we just cannot understand. How is it that on one hand you have men and women within the force who are there to serve and to protect, and yet on the other hand we have these ones who are there merely to, as I indicated, to eat a food, or they're just there to tear down the force?
Much to discuss. But let's jump to the other story, which is the remove hedge tax, says Paulwell. The opposition spokesman on mining and energy, Philip Paulwell, says that continuing increases in oil prices, which on May 17 reached over $80 a barrel for the first time in 4 years, has supported his call for the government to immediately scrap the existing tax on fuel that was intended to pay for the oil hedge insurance that was not renewed by the current government. Mr. Powell, the former minister, went further to state that despite the Jamaican people paying the government approximately $6.4 billion a year in a special tax on fuel, designated to pay for a hedge insurance against oil prices increase, the government has ended the oil hedge and has left the consumers at the mercy of the worsening oil market as the price of oil products continues to rise at the gas station locally. The oil hedge that was brought by the previous People's National Party-led government was meant to be an insurance policy against world oil prices and the increase, which were expected to reach over US$70 a barrel in the 2015-2016 period. It ensured that despite the rising prices on the global market, Jamaica would continue to buy oil at the agreed hedge price averaging around $66.74 a barrel. The hedge no longer in place and the current government showing no interest in renewing the arrangement. Jamaica must buy oil at the increasingly high world prices, which are passed on to the consumer in high prices of petrol, cooking gas, and other oil products. And Mr. Powell continues to encourage the government to immediately end the special tax on oil designated to pay this hedge. I agree with Mr. Powell. It can't be that we are paying an insurance or a tax, I should say, for something that doesn't exist. Now, I think we discussed this last week where I mentioned that I could understand why the government decided to remove the hedge, because it was a tricky situation that we were involved in, because we had the hedge in place and oil dropped significantly. Yes, but the drawback to it now is that we have seen where oil is back on the increase. So for planning purposes, it's hard for a government, and the BOJ governor said it, it's hard to plan when the prices of oil is so erratic. Yes, but at the same time, if we are paying taxes for a hedge, then we should have the hedge or the taxes be removed. But it can't be that we are paying taxes for something that we should be getting that doesn't exist. It can't be. And it is very imperative that the government, through its minister with responsibility for the hedge, to come out and say something about it. And I think it's necessary that it either be removed or we put another hedge in place.
Okay. Let me understand. I have some questions. So the government is charging us a tax, which is supposed to be that which was used for the edging.
Mm-hmm.
Correct? Because they no longer edge. And that was based on the fact that the oil prices was lower at the time, right? So they decided instead of edging, they're going to charge consumers this tax on the gas. Now that the gas has gone sky high, the consumers are still asked to pay for this, pay this tax, and there is no edging going on. So as I had said last week, why did this administration decide that it was prudent? So you're saying, and you're agreeing with, why, let me finish that thought first. Why, as I asked last week, why did this administration decide that they were not going to edge? Is it that for some political reasons? We don't know. But the other question then is, if the government decide to remove this tax, sir, as you are agreeing with Mr. Powell, where are they going to get that money from now to make up? Because it was budgeted for, you know. This is money that was in the budget as revenue. Yes?
No, but remember,
where
now,
are they going to get that money from?
Let me explain it. What had happened is that the government was paying a fixed sum for oil. Yes? So if oil, I think the amount, so for example, the amount was $66 a barrel. Yes? It's a fixed amount. So if oil go to $30 a barrel, we still pay $66. However, if oil go to $120, right?
It was hedged, is that my understanding?
Right. So if it even go to $120 while we had that hedge, then we would still pay $60. So the benefit to it is if it increases, we pay one money. If it decreases, though, we lose, but at the same time, we would still have a fixed amount that we pay. Now, the government decided that at the time, the PNP decided that we are paying for the hedge because the hedge naturally comes, you have to pay additional monies, whatever, for the hedge. It's like an insurance. So how we were paying for it is that we were paying a tax on fuel. And that tax would end up paying for the hedge. So what the opposition is saying, that since we no longer have the hedge, we don't have to pay that insurance. And if we don't have to pay that insurance, why is it that the people of the country is paying that tax? Which I totally agree with. We can't be paying a tax for something that it was original. Remember, it was painted to the people of this country that we're paying the insurance for the hedge. And
no,
that's
but
how we're paying it.
No, hold on. No, but the tax, the fuel tax, was never used for hedging.
No, man, remember
was
that.
Never used. When this administration came in, the tax was supposed to be the substitute for the hedging. Right, so we were no longer paying for hedging. You know that tax money when the government received it did not go for hedging.
Well, my understanding.
That's my understanding, and I mean we probably should get the minister or somebody to kind of clear up this for me, because my understanding is that money that was now being used as a tax, the gas tax, wasn't collected from the government and paying for hedging. It was money now that was collected and going into the government's coffers.
Well, I think it was at the end.
Because the gas price was trending down.
Yes, but remember that even though the gas price was trending down, the government was still part of the deal, so they still had to pay the insurance on the hedge. So when it expired, this administration they just did not renew the insurance that we were paying, right? So we weren't paying any insurance then, so to speak. So therefore, there's no guarantee then. Because remember, you know, with the hedge, you have to pay an insurance. It's like a guarantee that you're saying, all right, you get the oil at this amount, but you have to pay me $5 every month to keep the price at $66. So even if the price got to $100, your safeguard is that you pay me $66, but you still have to pay me that $5 insurance for the hedge that we have signed. Now, when it expired, we are still paying that tax, but at the same time, the government is not paying that insurance on the hedge because there's no hedge. And that's
right,
the problem.
So is it then, because if I'm listening you clearly, that money would have been collected, where would that money that was collected, so when the new budget was announced this fiscal year, there was this provision in there for this tax collected, right?
Well, clearly.
It seems to me like it
disappeared, as always, in the consolidated fund to fund other things. That's exactly what happened.
We'll wait and see. There are some questions and there are some answers that are needed from the minister, and to see how this one will fan out. I want to talk about, we were trying to see if we could get Sanjay listeners, somebody from the People's National Party to talk, secretariat that is, to talk to us about the runoff in Northeast St. Elizabeth for a replacement for Evan Redman. There is a contest between Basil Waite and Everton Fisher for someone to be the standard bearer for the People's National Party in the next general election if and when the prime minister decides to call it. At this time, the polls should have closed already. My understanding is that there are 1,100 delegates eligible to vote, and both candidates are pulling out all the stops. I was reading an update from the Gleaners website stating that persons were having issues when the polling stations opened this morning. There was accusations of fraud or attempt at fraud. It didn't say from which side. And then I read another update which says that if I could find it, Fisher cries fouls site intimidate. Hold on, let me see. There was one update about an hour, 2 hours ago that stated that those from the Basil Wade camp are declaring victory already, and I'm seeing an update that came in an hour ago that says Everton Fisher, the contender in the runoff for the constituency, is declared that he will not be intimidated by his opponent, Basil Wade. I have listened. I spoke to one of my contacts within the PNP, and he has indicated that based on what he knows, Mr. Fisher has the momentum on the ground, but whether or not Mr. Wade will be able to capture the delegates, we will have to wait and see. I'm just trying to see, sorry, Sanjay, listeners, mm-hmm. if there are any updates coming out of any of the PMP.
While you're doing that, though, I'm seeing, I was about to ask, why is it that Mr. Redmond decides to step aside? Because I remember that contentious election that they had with Raymond Price, yes? Mm-hmm. And the way they went about this entire, story. And I'm seeing here where now Evan Redmond is saying that his political career is taking a toll on his private business, and that's the reason why he decides to quit as MP after less than a term in office. Now, my question is to Mr. Redmond, you did not give this enough thought to have known that your political career would have taken up so much time? Remember how contentious that election was? And I believe, and I forever will say it, that Raymond Price was a fairly good MP. And the process of, in a sense, he demitted office was unfortunate. It would have been better to have a Raymond Price continue, who was probably doing well for his constituency and for the parliament, contributing in the parliament, than having Mr. Redmond sitting in parliament. For the time that Mr. Redmond is in parliament, what has been his contribution to the parliament?
I have not heard that man spoke in the parliament. I don't know if I missed it.
I must have missed it too.
Somebody can tell me. Somebody can point to me where I need to go and find it. But I've never heard that man even stood up in the parliament and ask a question of anyone, right? And that would be a good space. I'm seeing where someone has posted congratulations to Basil Wade. So I'm going to take it from that he has been elected as the standard or will be the standard bearer for the People's National Party in Northeast St. Elizabeth when that time comes around. I see already where a lot of the PMP bloggers are throwing words already. Because, you know, every side have their own set of candidates that they want to bring. So we'll see how that one work out. We'll probably try and see if we can get a hold of Mr. Wade sometime next week to see what is it that he is going to bring to that constituency different from what Mr. Redman has. But I was reading earlier, I think it was today or yesterday, an article where the people say that if they don't get the right candidate, they're going to vote Labour. I don't know that.
Yeah, but that's an old story. That is an old story because we have heard that when with Price and Redman, and we see what happened. So that story is old. But, you know, it goes back to the initial conversation that we're having where the quality of persons who we elect or select in some instances to be the standard bearer for the party, and especially in a safe seat who we know will become the member of parliament, what value will they add to the parliament? Because it's one thing to be on the ground and work very well on the ground, and that's very good. But I remember us, Ralston, having the very conversation about Evan Redman versus a Raymond Price. And what is it that Mr. Redman is going to bring to the parliament? And we have been vindicated because the history will now show that Mr. Redman, and as you say, you follow the parliament daily way more than I do. And you, if you haven't seen Mr. Redman contributing, and I certainly haven't seen him contributing anything to the parliament. And the very one term that Raymond Price was in the parliament, we can see where Raymond Price contributed to the parliament and to the discussion in parliament. So is it that Mr. Redman went to parliament to warm the benches? And who are the people that were put in?
I said on this program, and I will say it again, and I said it on this program when the discussion was for replacement for when the contest was going to come up for against Raymond Price, I said that there was an underbelly within the party, and there was an underbelly within the constituency to get rid of Raymond Price. There was nothing else. I do not think it had anything to do with his work in the constituency. I don't think it had anything to do with his performance as a member of parliament, but there was an underbelly which was working to ensure that he would not be the member of parliament, that they would at some point in time get him out. And that was exactly what happened. And as you clearly said, Sanjay, we had the discussion. We spoke about whether or not Mr. Redman was going to be an effective MP in the parliament. And it has not proven us wrong. And I have said it. You have said it. We have had the discussion. That man sat through the parliament. What is it? 2 years? Is it what? A year? Or was it 2 years?
2 years.
2 years. One or two. But he has sat through that parliament and he has not made one single contribution to governance in that parliament. Not even as much as to ask a government minister a question. Not even as much as to contribute something to what is going on in that parliament more than sit there daily. It is scandalous and it's disgraceful. And the people ought to demand, yes, that whoever comes to represent them in this next election, not because it's a safety, I think maybe a clear message needs to be sent, you know, to some of these people sitting in these safe seats, that they are not as safe as they think they are.
The safe seat mentality, you know, that's a problem, you know. this safe seat mentality is a problem, because the political parties, they don't feel they're good candidates in some of these safe seats. It's just who they feel like just fling somebody down there, because anybody you put there, they will win. And that's the problem. And then it speaks to the quality conversation that we have in the parliament. Because the parliament, listeners, as you know, is not only to represent your constituents, but there are crucial discussions that affect us as a country. Can you imagine the parliament pass laws that can lock up people? Yes? The very laws that the courts have to rule over. And these are some of the individuals that we put in our parliament to form the laws that will govern us as a people. We're in a serious crisis.
I see Mr. Powell is tagging me that I should tell the real reason, the precise reason he thinks Mr. Price was pushed out. Mr. Powell, I am not going to go down that road with you. We're almost at the end of the program, but I'll talk about it next week when we come back as to why I think, when we have Mr. Wade on to discuss what is it that he is going to bring different to that constituency. But I think the bigger issue, and I know Mr. Powell will agree with me, the bigger issue, it has to do with the whole issue of these presumably safe seats.
Serious issue. It's a serious issue that we have to look on, this whole idea of the safe seat mentality, and how is it that the political parties treat the safe seats. It's a safe seat, so therefore we don't have to focus on it, because anybody we put there, that's the thinking, we'll win. So there's no work or proper work that is done. For both parties, both parties are guilty of it.
I'm trying to remember Everton Fisher. The name is just ringing a bell. As someone who was in public service,
yes,
before.
He was a mayor.
Oh.
He was a mayor. Oh. Let me check.
There was something else about that. I'm just not the name. When I heard the name, it something jumped out at me that he was someone who was very prominent in the public sector.
I know that he was the mayor. He was the mayor in the mayor for Black River.
Oh, was he the one who had spoke about the Was he the one who had spoke about the 90?
No,
that's not.
That is in Clarendon.
Stop the apple cart. Was it?
No, that is Oh God, what's his name again? Donnie says it's 90 talk. That's in Clarendon, though. I remember specifically the statement that was made, the 90 talk, when he was talking about Richard Lazan, but that's in Clarendon. His name eludes me now, but I know who you're talking. Everton Fisher is in St. Elizabeth, and he was the former mayor of Black River.
Oh, okay. All right, listeners, let me remind you of our feedback question this afternoon. The question is, what is your reaction to the news from Indicom that members of the police force were planting guns on victims? And I have one response where Margaret is saying, if that is news, I guess people are not alarmed. People are not alarmed by because it's something that citizens of Jamaica have been complaining about all along.
I have some responses here as we wrap, listeners. Let me just pull that up. We see here Chad Morgan saying common assault. We also seen where Andrew Hansen is saying stale news, and Betty Ashley saying that them just to find that out. The name of the councillor is Carlton Bailey Ralston. Bailey from the Milk River Division. He was the one who made the 90 talk statement. And I gather that he was thrown out of the council a couple of months ago from another statement that he made.
Who? Bailey?
Yes. He was he was suspended for I think 3 sittings for a statement that he made at a council meeting. It came on the news.
Oh, I see. This GLP using their majority in the councils to throw out members.
Well,
I wonder what. Hold on just a moment. Let me complete my thought. I wonder what's going to happen to that councillor who I understand is still attending council meeting, the one where his firearm was found at a house. I listen, listeners, and I'll give you update when I hear what has happened to him.
But the councillors, and I'm not here to support or not support, but the council has a standing order, and the standing order was followed.
You don't think that standing order would apply to in a situation? He has been charged as a matter of fact, you know.
Was a resolution brought to the council?
No. I don't know if a resolution was brought to the council.
But I can't speak to the matter.
Do you agree? Do you agree that he ought to be suspended, or as a matter of
if he was charged, then in a matter of fairness, he step aside. I agree. He should take a leave of absence as a matter of principle.
They don't wish to act expeditiously, though. But listeners,
I'm not familiar with the matter, so I can't. I don't want to speak on it, because I'm not very familiar with the matter. I think I've heard some story about it, though, but I'm not very familiar with that particular matter.
Mm-hmm. All right, listeners, in talk history this week, in the year 1951, the budget debate in the House of Representatives collapsed. As a result, the House sets an all-time record for the shortest debate on the estimates of the colony. Also on this day, in 1964, Grace Heaven, a St. James Parish Councillor for the People's National Party, announced she is now a member of the Jamaica Labour Party. She was previously expelled from the PNP. Her announcement meant that the JLP had 10 seats to 9. That the PNP, rather, had 10 seats to 9 held by the JLP.
Before we go, Ralston, your comment on the move by the government to establish, or what seems to will happen, the parliament moving to Hero Circle.
I hear some environmental people making some quarrels about it. I've not really listened as to really what their argument is about. But if you let me make it clear, I'm not big on environment and all save this environment and all that, but their voices must be heard. And I think in his wisdom or lack thereof, it's a good move that the government is making. We need to have a parliament building that is keeping to date with technology and modern times. But some might ask the question, how is it that we're going to build this big, lavish parliament building when we can't even fix Cornwall Regional Hospital?
But you know,
it's our priority.
It's not even so much about that, because the parliament is woefully inadequate. So there's no question about the need for a new parliament building, because it's needed. But my question is, as a matter of urban planning and town planning, if Hero Circle is the right place to put that parliament building? That is my question.
What would be, okay? So on what basis? On what basis?
Just because remember that we with parliament being placed there, right at Hero Circle. Remember that we have 2 schools right up the corner, and we know that once parliament is in session, there is traffic restrictions. You can't drive past the parliament. Once parliament is in session, it's going to be chaotic for when school dismisses, where persons can't drive downwards into Hero Circle to Ministry of Education. So all the traffic will be diverted back, I would say, the northern end. That's going to be chaotic. Mm-hmm. And my question is, what thought went into that as it relates to urban planning? Yes, I could understand 15 years ago where the discussion may have been had about moving the parliament building there. But You should, if you go to Hero Circle at when school dismisses on any given day, it's already chaotic with the traffic. And then to put Parliament down there, no. I cannot agree with it at all. But I see the need. The need is there for a Parliament building. But we also have to think about green space. But you know, somebody made a very good point. We have a whole heap of lands up King's House. Put it up there. Why not put it up there? Anyways.
It's for this administration to tell us. I hope that they listen to the the different voices and that democracy is not a threat in this country. This has been Talk Jamaica. Special thanks, listeners, to you for having joined us this afternoon, whether you tuned in via talkjamaicaradio.com, the Talk Jamaica Radio app, or oneradio.link, and our listeners as well over at Zeno Radio. Until you hear my voice again, this is Rasta Chamberlain saying goodbye for now. Is this week is Labor Day?
Yes, Labor Day is on Wednesday.
Labor Day on Wednesday. Go out and work. I think the project is, the national project is to put ramps in places where they are none, so as to make it easier for our physically challenged to access buildings. They should start with the Parliament. I doubt there is accessibility for the physically challenged at that present Parliament.
Yeah, Labor Day is a very important part of our culture. It's just that it has lost, you know, the drive and the energy that, you know, you should have to go out and labor instead of going to beach and sleeping the entire day. You should contribute to give back to this country that we also love. So listeners, this has been Talk Jamaica. And on behalf of the Talk Jamaica production team, comprising producer Damian Perkins, our team of studio engineers and technical operators, and my co-host Ralston Chamberlain, we want to thank you for listening to Talk Jamaica. And join us next week, Sunday, for another edition of Talk Jamaica, its commentary at its best. My name is Sanjay Lewis. Have yourself a wonderful week.